The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Bittersweet is the feeling you get when you are happy about something, but it is also tinged with sadness. For example, you may feel safe in a new place, but feel sadness for the life and people you have left behind. You may discover new people in your life after losing someone close to you. You may discover something you had thought was lost forever, or a new exciting career path may appear after a traumatic event. Nothing can prepare you for the unforeseen tragedies that take place in our world. When you've experienced pain, hurt, and trauma, it can cause you to react in unhealthy ways, a natural fear response to protect yourself. These podcasts are about inspirational people who have reconstructed their lives and responded in transformational ways following huge traumatic events. NBS Bittersweet Podcasts are brought to you by Cultural Conversations, an arts-based hub where those who feel a sense of otherness lead the way. I'm your host, Tanya Nock, and today's guest is Ali Kawaji. Thank you for having this kōrero with me. I'm really looking forward to it.
Thank you for having me, Tanya. I was so excited to be here with you. That's probably, definitely my first time to be on a podcast and be interviewed about my, you know, my journey through this, you know, life. So thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So can we just start at the beginning of your life, and can you talk to us a bit about that, where you were born and where grew up?
So I am from Iraq. I am from the state of Nineveh. I was born in Mosul city, which is northwest of Iraq. I come from a family that are have a long history in that city, and my father is a professor in mechanical engineering, and my mom, she's a professor in biochemistry as well. We're a family of, you know, three brothers: me, my brother Omar, and my youngest brother Muhammad. And we're like all over the world. Omar was born in the United States, and he lives there. And Muhammad, he's a pharmacist, and he now, he's in UK.
So what did it look like? What was Mosul like in those
Mosul
days?
Mosul is it's unique by itself. The culture we got was preserved by the Mosul people. We speak a quite different dialogue from the rest of Iraq. We speak Arabic, but the dialogue we speak is quite significantly different from the rest of Iraq. Mosul is the city of prophets, they call it. Really rich in history, ancient history from the Assyrian empire. Living in that type of a multicultural diversity and religion. So Mosul, the population is split between Muslims and Christians. And you have from old mosques that has a rich background in history from when the Crusaders signed with the Ayyubi, Salahuddin Ayyubi, some of the treaties between back in, I don't know which century, when Palestine or Orshalim was pretty much a conflict in old ages. So all that in history, in Islamic history, and ancient history is really rich. And the people there kept that culture, tried their best to, move it and pass it on from one generation to another. My grandfather, during the First World War and the Second, he was pretty much an educator as well. He is a carpenter, and he taught trades to young Maslawi people, and then he opened his own factory, and it was quite popular in the neighborhood. And where I came from, and my family is from the old city of Mosul, which is close to what we call the Great Mosque, and it's a an in a point and a site that for people who come to Mosul, they go there. And that's where, you know, it was built by one of the leaders of the Islamic era and called Salah ad-Din Ayyubi. He was an Islamic Khalifa and a leader during the Crusades war.
Okay, so yeah. I'm just trying to get my, because I know that I'm quite a bit older than you, so I'm just getting my decades right here. So would you have been a child under Saddam's regime then?
Yes, so I was born in Iraq, and my first year, my parents moved to the States. And to follow on their postgrads and living there, and I got to the extent to where I felt I, you know, living in a certain way in a Western system and society. And when we went back, it was after, well, when pretty much the Iraq-Iran war was coming to an end, and my father said, "I need to go back and just, you know, check on my family." So he's the eldest, and traditionally, in our culture, the eldest son will look after the rest of the family if, you know, when my grandfather passed away, or the head of the family, which is the father, passed away. When we went back, and we were still enjoying, I was young, I didn't know what was, you know, what's the Iraqi culture. It was all new for me. I was almost like probably seven, eight years old. I was trying to, you know, take all that in me. And I was like, oh, this is where I come from. Oh, I thought I come from Colorado, Fort Collins. But no, this is actually my roots here. And then there was the Saddam regime. And Saddam was escalating problem and the issues between Iraq and Kuwait. And by the time we were trying to catch up on, you know, family and all that, we realized like we're in the Iraq-Kuwait conflict. So the regime of Saddam was pretty much based on dictatorship. You cannot oppose the system. You cannot say anything about the regime. You cannot say one word about Saddam or how he's running the country. And if you do, then there's severe punishments, not only upon you, upon your family, your tribe, and the ones who have connection to you. So the circle gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and the punishment gets severe.
So as a child, did you feel safe? Could you play in the streets? What was school like?
You can, as a child, I didn't realize what's the threats that can be coming upon you until when I was in intermediate. And then you see certain things like, don't talk about the Ba'ath party, Saddam's party. Don't talk about Saddam. Don't even talk about his entourage. If there's a member of the Ba'ath party, you cannot stand up against them. So a certain way of being safe has its own standards. So you need to stay away from them and obey them. You can play, you can live, but if there's anything that you need to take upon to make that party and Saddam regime survive, then you will sacrifice that. And if you say no, then you're not safe. So it's
safe from who? So who's there?
You don't know.
Right.
That's the scary part. That's the dark part of things. You don't know who's your, in that point, you don't know who's your enemy or where's the threat is going to come from. And every time, you know, you walk into through this raw experience, you as a young teenager, I didn't know what to do. I don't know. I was like, what type of reaction I should take? What type of actions I should take in that point? And what do I do? And I remember my father says, keep your head down and don't talk and don't say anything. And if they want you to praise him, praise him. And as a young teenager, I was like, why? Why we have to, you know, do this? We're already suffering. When I was 10 years old and the Gulf War happened, that by itself, when I go back and think about it, I was like, how did my mother cope with that? Three boys,
And a family to feed.
I mean, a family to feed.
Mm. How did the economic sanctions affect your family?
Oh, it was horrendous. It was awful. Like, you know, you get paid what's the equivalent. My mom and dad, they get paid what's the equivalent monthly, $5 with three boys. And I don't know how they made it through.
So were you hungry? Do you remember?
There were times like we had to eat whatever my mom had. We had to go back and leftovers is like your main dish now. Clothing, no. My mom used to take my father's clothes and resize them on us. And we were young kids. My mom used to, you know, patch all the jeans and pants and all that to make sure the next boy will wear them.
And this went on for how long, do you remember?
This went on for like 9 years, 10, 9 years. And it was like, people look at me now and they go, ah, you love to travel, you love to spend. I was like, I need to catch up on life. You guys have no idea what we had to go through. My whole teenage life was gone. There's no time to love. There's no time to go through all the, you know, typical teenage things that were, you know, any teenager goes through and, you know, experience. I didn't have that. I was pretty much on survival mode from that day. I was 10 years old and I was working in a laundromat. 10 years old. There, I can tell you the number of stories of times where I slept on a bus and I missed the bus stop going home. And I've been dropped in a 20, 30 minutes walk neighborhood that I need to go back home. So we don't have cell phones. We don't have landlines. So my mother knows where's her 10 years old son now. And I remember walking towards the street to our neighborhood. And I see my mom. She's like, you can see her drop dead, like no blood in her face, worried about me, 10 years old. And I go like, now I'm looking at it back. And I look at my son, my eldest son, Mahmoud. And I go like, can I trust putting him on the bus when he's 10? No, probably not. That's not a right thing to do as a parent. But then that's the only way we can survive.
So can we move on to the fall of Saddam?
Yeah.
And what that was like, that feeling at the beginning.
My God. That feeling brings back memories, hard ones. And it's a mix of joy and then, is this real? You know what I mean? Like, you go like, is Saddam gone? And that time I was in college, so I was aware of, you know, every single moment. I'll take you through this experience, the journey. Particular that time, I was in college at night, and Saddam media machine came out and said, everyone, bunker in your houses, it's getting worse this time. Now, they give you little, and of course, Saddam media machine will say, we're winning, we're victorious. Of course, any dictator will try to praise himself and calm the nation down, because he knows the nation will rally against him in any moment. And I was at my college and my school, and me and my friends were like, I think we're second year or third year engineering, or I was doing my computer engineering degree. And we're talking. And the reason why we're there, we're worried about our computers. We had one lab for the whole college. If that lab is gone, if anything happens to it, that means our education will be posed. And then we don't know what's going to happen to us. And we're coming to the end of our studies, college years. And I remember my friend, Omar Rafet, he was one of my dearest friends. And we're sitting in the lab, and I took a nap. And he woke me up around 3 a.m. He said, it's over. I said, what's over? He said, we need to go home. And our college building from my house was about an hour walk. Pitch dark, no electricity. We heard the tomahawks and the aircraft above our heads bombarding us, like just throwing all this type of, you know, missiles and all. I was like, no, it's not over. He said, he was tearing. He was like, Ali, it's over. We need to go home. If we want to live, we need to go home now. I was like, let me pick my bag. He said, we don't have time to pick our bags. Let's go. And we're rushing. We're a group of six young guys rushing out of the building in the dark, going home. Now, how I'm going to know my friends are going to get home safe, I don't know. It's all we put faith in each other that we're going to go straight home. I got home. I was soaked in tears. I was like, this cannot be the end. What's going to happen to us? Is it the all over again, the 1990 Gulf War, when the Americans got also close to take over, take down the regime, and they pulled out, and then we're going to go through the whole Saddam, his party coming, picking up people and throwing them in jails and torturing us and all that? What's going to happen? We had little faith in the outside world, what they're going to do. And we woke up one morning, and I remember this vividly. I saw flags in Humvees, flags that I never thought in my whole life, 13 years, I'll see in the streets of Iraq. The American flag, the British flag, the Kurdistan flag, flags I have no idea, no recollection where they, what country they represent. And we just opened the radio and we heard Saddam is gone. Now, in that moment, a dictatorship that's sitting on the throne of Iraq for 30 years, like that, gone. You start pinching yourself and going, is this real? Does that mean we can walk in the streets and talk about how bad that regime was without being killed or threatened? And then from there, it was trying to cope with that.
So who took over after? What?
We didn't know until we hear stories through the media, because the Iraqi people were in such a joy of that, you know, finally the borders are open. Life is easy now to go through. There's no type of impulse of threat from Saddam regime on us. Then we heard that the Americans are trying to set up a civil governor to be running the country. And then what happened after the war was people also busy because, you know, there were riots and people just taking whatever over banks, over universities, and, you know, there's big riots, people stealing and all that. The hunger was killing the Iraqi people. That was the gap and that the rest of the world didn't know. Iraqis were suffering from inside because of the sanctions. And whatever food for oil programs the United Nations put forward, that was all hijacked by Saddam's regime and his family to live a certain luxurious life. And then passing to the Iraqis was just peanuts. They brought generals and civilians from the Bush administration to run the country, who have no idea about how to run a country. Dysfunctioning the security forces, opening the borders wide, destroying every single thing. They scrapped away the constitution of Iraq. And then they prepped, they did the same thing how they brought Saddam to power. They prepped a group of Iraqis who were the opposition of Saddam's regime, and brought them in with no type of process or anything. Iraqi people thought, the world is helping us to take that regime out, and then we'll take over our country. But that was not the case then. I think the whole world heard George Bush Jr. saying, well, we invaded Iraq. And then when that hit, we realized we're not going to survive this.
So can you talk about the Islamic State and what happened for you?
After the 2003 war, Iraq had a year and a half of, you know, a nice flourish economy and lifestyle and all that. And then when the Americans came in and took away all the security forces, all our systems down and all that, and opened the borders, we saw a wave of insurgents, Al-Qaeda, radical groups coming in. And it was it was something that we didn't realize, like, what's happening now. And because if you go to school, if you speak English, if you associate with any NGOs or any foreign organization, you'll be killed. Until the certain period of 2005, 2007, when the Americans, the U.S. Army and the coalition forces and somehow disrespected our holy places, which is in Najaf and Karbala, and then spike a civil war. During that civil war between Sunni and Shia, what happened is the borders are open, ISIS start developing. Now, most, again, there's probably a gap of history, how ISIS got to be that powerful. And then it's again, it's from, I would not say the Western nations, it's the governments who built that death machine and unleashed it on us. So ISIS came in after 2007, taking the fractions of the fabric of the Iraqi people, taking advantage of that, and they took over Mosul. At that time, I had to escape. We had to leave Mosul. My father got threatened by Al-Qaeda. I was pretty much hunted by them. They wanted me.
So why did they want you?
Certain things, because first of all, my father is a professor, and they target the high intellectual people, intelligent people, and they don't want that, because they know these are the people who can lead the country towards success, good stability, and contribute. So, and for me, because I worked with the government, with the coalitions, for to advertise about what are my country needs. And then because my type of connections with these groups, I've been a target, a high target for Al-Qaeda. And then one day when I remember my brother almost, he got killed because of that. And the reason why, because on his passport, on his Iraqi identification, you know, they gave him a temporary identification. It was written, the place of his birth is America. So anything you associate with those words, America, UK, or anything, Al-Qaeda, ISIS will come after you. So we had to leave. And it was a horrible experience for me. I didn't get a chance to say goodbye to my friends, my family. I didn't even get a chance to pack my valuables. I just had to take a backpack, and out we are.
And where did you go?
The first stop for me was in Kurdistan, Iraq, which was like a safe haven for Iraqis, because the Kurds, since 1990, they had control of that region. So it was quite safe there. I stopped there, worked for a while, established good relationship with friends and business partners there. And then after that, it was not enough, because then if they know you're still in the country and they cannot get to you, what they do, they chase after your family, your extended family. And at that point, I had to disappear. So I left Iraq in around 2007. And my journey began from there, from UAE. And then after that, I pretty much traveled most of the Asia countries and Southeast Asia.
And so that was it? You didn't go back to Iraq after that?
I remember me and my father having that conversation. I was like, I want to go back home. And my father said, from this point on, 15 years to 20 years, you're not going to think about home. And I couldn't go back. And it left a huge hole in me. And I struggled with homesick, depression, all sorts of things. No matter what happens to me, good things happen to me. I move forward in life. I achieve things. It was not the same anymore. I couldn't go back home. And for me, to submit my feelings, my roots together back in Iraq, I didn't have the chance to give back to my country. I didn't get a chance to say goodbye. This is really close to my heart, one of the horrible experiences I had, and I promise my dear friend who got killed by Al-Qaeda, Wissam, and we were in college. And I remember seeing his mom, and I promised her that we will live up to his legacy and make sure that we, you know, give back to our country and, you know, and try our best to build it back. I didn't do that. It's like an unfinished mission for me. Mm. And that hole in my heart keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And you start living with something called homesick. And homesick becomes like a flu. It hits you every time you have any triggered memory of home. Can you pick up your passport and go back? No, ISIS was there. ISIS captured Mosul. Where am I going to go? Mosul is my home. It's taken by ISIS. And every time we open the news and ISIS destroyed an ancient site, I cry. They leveled so many historic sites. And the only thing I can give is my tears. And for a person like me who is pretty much proud where I, you know, as any other Iraqi where I come from, any person in this room and outside will be proud where they come from and what the countries and who they represent. For me, it was so hard. And that also comes with a heavy tax you need to pay. And when you go through airports now, you're from Mosul. ISIS got, you know, Mosul. So are you affiliated with them? Are you in contact with anyone who is and within that, you know, barbaric group? And you're like, no, I actually had to run away from them. Why you have
exactly,
to?
Exactly, yes.
If you know me, you will not say these words. And you become numb to it at some point.
So but what brought you to New Zealand?
What brought me to New Zealand, a beautiful woman, my wife, who she's a Kiwi. We met through friends and family members, and we start, you know, online long distance dating. And she met her a couple of times. She came to Kuala Lumpur, and we were in Kuala Lumpur. I popped the question to her, surprised her. She was so excited, and we told the family, and they all came over to KL. And we had this beautiful small ceremony with my close friends in Southeast Asia and also from Africa. I have some friends who attend my ceremony. And she lived with me for 2 years, and she's like, do you want to come to New Zealand? And I was like, well, yeah, I'll give it a try. Let's go. And I came to New Zealand. And for me, it was just an eye-opening journey to...
So, did you come as a migrant or a refugee?
As a migrant, I would say, yes. So, I hold quite solid principles in my life, and a lot of people say, oh, if you come like a refugee, you know, there's certain benefits to it. And, of course, where I come from, my case will be stronger because, you know, from Mosul and United Nations is pretty much involved heavily with the people who have been displaced from Mosul and all that. But then if you look back at all the time when I look at my passport, it's like, you know what? I know where I come from. I know my country is going through a rough time, but, you know, end of the tunnel, there'll be light. And I'm capable. I'm a capable individual who I think I can survive certain ways, and probably there's other people who need that help more than me.
So I wonder if you could help me, because I know that there are two meeting places on a Friday above the ANZ Bank and Hardy Street. So is one of them Sunni and one of them Shia? Faith?
For the faith, they both represent both sides, I believe, like the Sunni and Shia. People who are Muslims can go pray there, as my understanding. The two groups there are being led by different management or different leadership on the top of, you know, the organization of both the BNZ mosque and the NMIT, the mosque behind the NMIT. As far as my understanding, yes, they welcome this. Of course, as a Muslim, a mosque is a place where everyone can come in. We call it the house of Allah, and only that you need to know, and you can walk in and you can pray, and you can feel safe, and you can practice your beliefs.
So when you came to New Zealand, you were recovering from PTSD.
Yeah.
And you had some therapy for this, and then you were feeling...
I was, in the first time when I start realizing that, I had PTSD, and a couple of friends of mine saying, like, yeah, it's noticeable on you. You get triggered easily, and then I really go to my defense mechanism comes up with no reason. Like, well, in New Zealand, it's safe. But then I realized, and some of my colleagues say, oh, you're in a safe place. And they're like, well, it's not like a switch. You can flip it and then everything's okay. It's just a stacked events in the background that carries on, and you carry it on your shoulders, and that has so much impact on your mental health. And then I start looking into what type of, medical attention or, help I need from a therapist. And I start recovering from that until a point that nationwide New Zealand knows about, when Christchurch happened. And that just opened all sorts of,
So it brought back the PTSD. PTSD
again back to me. It hit me so hard. And made it even probably worse for me. One of our dearest friends, she's from Mosul, and she's also an artist, I would say. She lost her son in the Al-Noor Mosque. He was praying, and he came out, and then when the whole shooting happened, he would run back in to save people, pull them out, but unfortunately, he lost his life. And he was her only son. He was almost my age. I went down to Christchurch to be in the funeral, and it's like everything came back. A flood of those emotions and memories, like dark memories and horrible memories I had, all came flooding back. And to the extent I just couldn't tolerate it anymore. I went and seek, help and all that. And I got through some of my sessions, and we talked, and then I tried to, find things that I can hold on and, just keep on pushing through this life. And one thing I realized, you need always to open up about these things. You just cannot contain it and shut it down. It's not that easy. And I start realizing that around my environment with the people around me, and I start, sharing that awareness.
Well, I really admire you sharing your story today.
Yeah, it's like all my, my friends and some of my students. I'm not a professional, but it's like, don't worry. It's nothing to be ashamed of. It's okay, seek help. New Zealand is doing really well on that front, all sorts of, places and professional people that you can call, even if you don't want to go one-on-one in person and talk to a therapist, or you just can give a call. They have, those hotlines that can support you and all that.
So, and have you had any racism or hostility in Nelson?
In an indirectly way, sometimes you feel that. And as they say in English, until you flip the rock, you cannot say it, but it's there. It's what overpowers that. It's the good people. Cultural Conversation, for example, is the place that you feel like, you find those good people there who are united in this. There's in every way you find that group, an army of good fellas that there's like behind you. And when I came back from Christchurch, I saw that. And they did stand on the steps of the cathedral to support, Muslims and the New Zealand Kiwi Muslims, and even those who are residents in this country. I remember, a couple of incidents that happened, and the people of the Nelsonians and the people of Nelson, the residents, rallied around those to support and all that. So in ways, yes, you find that. And until you pay attention to it, sometimes this is what we need to be vigilant about and be aware about. Don't let it go. I learned about this the hard way. If you let it go, if you, someone's been just, you know, racist with you, stand up. Because if you let it go, then you might don't care, but the next person who's going to experience that might hit him so hard. So you'll be like, you know, you'll be the first person to take that, and you don't need to stand up aggressively. No, you educate people. Talk to them. Tell them, come sit down with me. Why, you know, why are you angry? Why are you against me? Do you know me? Let me share with you who I am. Let me tell you my story, and I'll hear your story. And maybe we can meet halfway, you know? It's all about to take care of this planet. We need to come together. We need to put our differences aside. We need to share our values. It's okay. I'm no way a threat to anyone. I'll be a threat to myself first before I be a threat to anyone. I'll not let that happen. I'll protect you. Just let's sit down, have a chat. Let's have a cup of tea, cup of coffee, have a laugh, you know. And, you know, you'll find me, I'm a quite easy person to go with, you know. And then that's what, I get angry sometimes, but then I go back. It's like, you know what? They don't know me. Let me go up to them and tell them, hey, come sit with me. I'll buy you a coffee. It's okay. It's worth then to know each other.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, I think you're truly amazing, and we're so lucky to have you on the board.
Thank you. So I'm so excited to be with you guys.
It's just lovely to have you on the board. And an honour to hear your story.
Thank you so much, Sam.
And you've been listening to MBS Bittersweet Podcast, inspirational people who have reconstructed their lives and responded in transformational ways. These podcasts have been funded by MBS and produced by Aham Sound for Cultural Conversations. I'm your host, Tanya Nock. Thank you for taking the time to listen. Thank you. And thank you so much, Ali Khawaji,
for being here today. Thank you. Appreciate that.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.